I don't understand that.
My experience has been is that the orders that at least the judges in Multnomah and probably Washington and Clackamas counties are giving, are allowing now with regards to custody, are what are called temporary protective order of restraint, which prohibits either party from taking the child out of the family residence. That's different than giving one of the parties temporary custody. What it does is force both parents to either stay in the home or make a decision on, you know, what's going to happen with this child. So I see that as very different than an award of temporary custody.
Isn't it common in whenever you have an award of custody and the use of the house, that one of the folks leaves the house in theories?
At least in Multnomah County, the judges aren't awarding temporary custody without a full-blown hearing, which means mediation, a custody evaluation. And I don't know what's going on in other counties. But at least in Multnomah and Washington counties, we cannot get temporary custody without the full-blown family services process, unless there is an emergency situation.
You file a petition for temporary custody, and you get a hearing, and everybody stays in the house for a couple of weeks while you wait for a hearing date? Is that what happens?
No. You've got two, in a situation where there's abuse going on and somebody applies under the Family Abuse Prevention Act, you're going to get a temporary custody order, okay? If there's no abuse, the Multnomah County judges are not awarding temporary custody unless they have been through a full-blown hearing on the custody issue. And before they get to a hearing on the full-blown custody issue, the parties have to go through mediation and evaluation by family services.
Okay, but you said if there is no abuse. I'm talking about where the wife says, he yelled at me, screamed at me, pushed me, shoved me around. You can't get an order saying, it's your house, your child, husband be out by 4 o'clock.
Yes, and under the Abuse Prevention Act, yes.
No, I'm talking about in the restraining order for divorce. As part of the divorce, isn't that just standard?
No. That's not been my experience.
Okay, if the wife alleges all that, then the judge here says you will have a hearing and find out if I believe this.
But to do that, she needs to, that process must be brought with the allegations that were brought under the Abuse Prevention Act.
I think, is it not the case that oftentimes they're done simultaneously?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
But it's actually the Family Abuse Protection Act that gets you the restraining order.
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mason.
Well, just a very short comment. Thank you, Ms. Brown, for your second paragraph. You articulated my concerns much better than I did, that indeed this would be used in the custody battles, inappropriately used. And by the way, I might say my caricature earlier of how this happened probably has been ameliorated in Multnomah County by what she's talking about. But it used to be, prior to that mediation, that's pretty much the way it was. And I think that they became aware of that. And now I want to be clear on that. I haven't done domestic relations law for several years, but that's pretty much the way it is now. But that used to be the way it was.
That's correct, Representative Mason. We, the judges, have frowned upon the private bar using the Family Abuse Prevention Act solely to get custody, a leg up in custody. And frankly, the judges are very careful about when attorneys are involved in those cases. Is there anything further? Any further questions?
Questions? All right. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yetta Helmley. Welcome, and please give us your name, both of you, for the record, and give us your testimony, please.
My name is Vietta Helmley, and I'm the director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service here in Salem. Our program is a member of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I am opposed to HB 2410. The reason that our program would oppose it, we would join with the coalition in opposing this, is because of all of the testimony that has gone before us. What we would like to have here in Oregon, and here in Salem in particular, I would like to see this. abuse occurs, the police are called, an arrest is made, the abuser gets hauled down to the jailhouse. At jail, you know, he might get put in jail, or she. And then if he or she is released, she is told, you will not contact these people, and if you do, then we will come and get you again. And I would like it to be that simple. Unfortunately, it's not that simple, so we had to develop the Family Abuse Prevention Act to account for the fact that people could not always count on the police or the justice system to take care of the protection of the victims. We barely get our needs met with the Family Abuse Prevention Act. If there are ways it can be abused, those ways will be found. People who are abusers they look at the law and they look for how they can get as close to the line as possible without quite stepping over it. And their job in life, because they're abusers, is to step as close to the line as possible without going over it. And we need to have laws that legitimately protect people rather than make things very complicated, and we don't want things that foil themselves in the process of trying to protect people. We know that when this law gets, when the Family Abuse Prevention Law gets attacked, it is because somebody has gone to a judge and lied, or gone to a judge and misrepresented the facts. And that's what happens when it gets abused. When it comes to the highly volatile issues of child custody cases, especially those where parents are alleging abuse of children against the other parent, we need to have an investigative process. Otherwise, the case simply will not be dealt with properly. We also want the system involved. We want the justice system involved in child abuse investigations. This is not a decision that should be left between the two parents. The adults in an abusive family relationship simply have to have help from outside in order to intervene properly in child abuse situations. They cannot be left to deal with those things alone. It is too hard. Child abusers or adult abusers are too manipulative for the average person to be able to withstand their manipulations and coercions. And they need the outside eyes of all Oregonians to help protect victims.
Chairman?
Representative Parks.
You know, I know you're real concerned about this, and I am too. But you're setting up a thing that guarantees a large involvement.
Yes.
Of government. And it would seem to me that in doing that, there you may be taking the, I don't know what you want to call them, borderline cases, or you may be prolonging a situation because a woman just doesn't want to get involved in that. She's got enough problems going on as it is now. And so rather than go through all the mechanics and the police and the juvenile court and the petition and so forth, she lets it ride. And
right.
Don't you see that as a potential problem with your approach?
Almost all of us do. Having worked with domestic violence and child abuse issues for the last about 20 years, I've come to understand that this is not something that occurs within the family and can be managed within the family. That's still the belief of most of us. Most of us still believe that child sexual assault. A parent sexually assaults the child. No report is made. We decide to deal with it in the family. Trust me, that is not what happens. What happens is that the abuse goes on and on and on without intervention at all. So I know what you're saying, and I am just totally against government intervention as much as possible, but I don't believe that our citizens have sufficient clarity and sufficient understanding of child abuse to be able to manage it in the family. I think it needs to be dealt with by the community.
Right. Chair Clark, my name is Judith Armada. I'm attorney for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and I'm basically just here to lend some support. But if I could, I'd like to address an issue that Representative Parks has raised. And I think that what happens with child abuse, and especially with, I think all kinds of child abuse, but especially with child sexual abuse, if there's enough evidence, you have a criminal prosecution. If there's not enough evidence, that's where the dilemma is. And to take that case to an abbreviated proceeding under the Family Abuse Prevention Act, you can't prove it. There's already difficulty in gathering that kind of evidence when you have two attorneys involved, and when you have enough money to get the kind of experts you need to investigate, sometimes you still can't prove it. But for two lay citizens to go before the court and to say, there has been child sexual abuse here, or there's been child abuse, I know it doesn't show, but I want a restraining order. For the most part, it's not going to happen. There's not going to be enough evidence there.
All right. Committee, we're going to have to move along. We've got still lots more witnesses on lots more bills. And so I hate to cut it off. If there are any burning questions, we'll have one more question to these witnesses. Otherwise, we're going to have to move on. Thank you very much for coming. We have two more witnesses on House Bill 2410 who I've just been informed about. And so we'll ask Zetta McDaniel and Joan Simmons, representing mothers opposed to molest situations, to come on up. And while the witnesses are taking their seats, I'll tell you that we'll then go to 2409 and hear from Mr. Welch, who can explain that bill for us. And then we'll move into a work session on some other bills. We have a lot of work to do in an hour. Welcome. Please give us your name for the record and let us know your thoughts.
I'm Joanne Simmons, and I'd like to clarify. We came as individuals today.
Right.
We brought some literature from an organization that we've been involved with, but I think the organization will have some direct contact with you.
Okay.
We wanted to come today as parents of molested children. And compared to the testimony that you've heard, ours is going to sound a lot different. We agree with many of the things that we've heard since we came through the doors. I came today to talk sort of generically to you about the Task Force on Sex Offenses Against Children and to say a few words about how much mothers and children need legislative action and support from the courts to help them deal with the devastating effects of the sexual abuse of children. Just to give you an example, I'm the mother of a molested child. My daughter was molested nonviolently at the age of 7 or 8. No overt threats or coercion were made by her father, who was the perpetrator. He was a seemingly respectable man, a juvenile court counselor from Lane County. His power over my daughter was very subtle, but she says, I knew what I had to do. I found out almost by accident about the molestation. To this day, I'm not certain that my daughter would have been able to tell me if she had known that it would get her dad in trouble. As his protector and caretaker, I do not know if she could have testified in court at the age of 7 or 8. On the few occasions when she does discuss the abuse now, when she gets to the actual details, she stops, is embarrassed, and says, it's too gross to talk about. This daughter is now 22 years old and has ongoing confusion about her father, alternately hating him and feeling sorry for him. She sometimes tells people that she has no father, even though he lives in the same town. She also offers him just another chance. I've heard that several times. And she takes her own children to visit him. Because of this firsthand experience with the confusion, helplessness, and powerlessness of my own now adult, bright, and assertive child, I'm doubly aware of the difficulties that other mothers must experience. In some ways, we were fortunate. I was already divorced, so we didn't have these custody issues. I had custody of both my children. We had a means to survive, though not well, without his meager child support payments. Small children and their teachers are now being asked to tell us about child molestation. We must give these children and their non-offending parents the legal supports that they need to make our reporting laws work. As an aside, I would refer to Jan Heinemann's work in Malheur County. She has told us that children are re-traumatized if, when they tell us about abuse, we are unable to protect them. And she thinks that, I've heard her speak, about how these children are damaged even more severely after they have reported because of unwitting acts by the community and the courts and their own parents than they were by the actual incidents that happened to them. Regardless of our good intentions, removing children from their homes and non-offending family members to protect them from suspected offenders sends a powerful negative message to victims that they, and not the offender, are being punished. These children have every reason to believe that they have done wrong by telling. Is it any wonder that they would recant or be too distraught to testify? My own adult daughter, who is a recovering methamphetamine addict, would, I think, be risking her sobriety if she were allowed to testify today, even 15 years later. Offenders and defenders of civil rights laws are probably going to be quite vocal about legislation such as the things that you are considering. But I would ask that you listen equally to the still small voices of women and children as you make these important decisions concerning sexual abuse of children.
Thank you very much. Ms. McDaniel.
I came here today as a member of society, a parent and a grandparent, also as a member of Mothers Opposed to Molest Situations. What I have to say has to do with a knowledge and a life experience rather than the other legal things you heard today. What I am applauding today is the fact that there's been some move towards listening finally to this type of issue and making some moves towards legislation and hearing what victims and people that deal with victims have to say. Having been involved within a cycle of an abusive family relationship, I am more than aware and understand the specific dynamics surrounding abuse and its cycle. Because of this life experience, I am concerned about the lack of the rights of children and the non-offending supportive parent or custodian. By understanding the dynamics of abuse firsthand, I am gratified to see these changes coming about to ensure safety of children and to finally recognize child abuse. Child abuse is an overwhelming issue, whether it deals with physical, emotional, verbal, mental, spiritual, or chemical abuse or sexual abuse. The home is supposedly a safe place, but it's not so with abused children and women. One of the statements I heard very clearly was that abuse is not manageable within the family, and that is truly, truly correct. And there is not a sufficient amount of information and clarity within this outside of the system. Unless you've lived in a situation of this nature, you really can't understand the dynamics of it. There have been very few avenues for support and intervention, so I'm very pleased at the heightened awareness of new laws regarding child abuse. Such changes as we've seen in these House bills that we're talking about today, it means that someone is finally listening to people that have experienced that abuse and its aftermath. I'm just going to kind of skip down through because I don't want to take too much more time. House Bill 204 just shows to me that there is an understanding of implementing faster procedure for removal of a child from a situation that is that needs to protect its safety fully. This also recognizes that the myth that a child's gender may protect him or her from abuse, and that it also recognizes that children may experience different types of abuse from the same offender. It is important not to disrupt a child from a home environment if it can be made safe by removal of the suspected offender. House Bill 2409 addresses the pressure put on a child to recant disclosure. This disclosure may be significant if basic needs of both the family and the victim are dependent upon the primarily support of the suspected offender. Children need to know that they are victims and not the cause of whatever else happens within a family structure. A non-supportive custodial parent often have their own issues surrounding abuse, which makes it difficult to deal with disclosure and follow-up. And this is another one of the dynamics that has to do with manageability within a family system because of abuse. 2410 expands the scope of a household to include all children within a household. And this, to me, says that it's considering the changes society has made from a primary household to diverse cohabitation. I believe it's very appropriate to identify households more specifically for legal purposes. It is vital that child abuse, especially child sexual abuse, no longer remain secrets and swept under society's rug. In general, I support the action that's taken here today because it is groundbreaking. I want you to know I'm willing to share my experience and my expertise and talk to anyone on a personal basis regarding my own story and my children's story. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We do not often hear the still small voices to which you referred, and we appreciate you bringing those to us. Representative Mason.
Yeah. I don't know which person to address my question to. They handed out a brochure here entitled Moms. And that's your organization?
This particular group is in Eugene, and we've been doing support groups for mothers of molested children since 1986.
Well,
you found something erroneous in the pamphlet?
Well, I've got some statistics on here that are so pervasive, I really would like to know where they come from and like to get some background of them and like them explained to me somewhat. For instance, it says here one of three girls is molested before the age 18.
There are a number of studies done about the numbers of girls, numbers of adult women who report. We've heard everything from one out of three to one out of five. We deliberately chose that statistic because we believe that the majority of women did not tell. Many victims say that they did not tell until well into their adulthood, if ever. So we took a fairly generous statistic for our purposes.
And then it says here 50% of the molesters are family members.
I wish I had with me the statistics that are the most recent from Children's Services. And I can't tell you right off the top of my head what they are. They generally point toward the offenders being known to the victims, and generally over half at least are family members of some kind. Most frequently, parents or parent figures.
So according to this, then, if I can, some simple math, and pardon my simple math, If 50% of the molesters are family members, and one out of three girls is molested, that would mean, according to those statistics, one out of six girls, because you've got only 50% are family members of the molesters.
Of the children molested. I think is the way that
I'm going to suggest that we're going to have to move on,
okay.
And I'm going to perhaps we could invite you to send the statistics from Children's Services,
okay.
Division that you were talking,
okay.
About to Representative Mason, because we
could I just say
sure.
One final thing about the statistics. The woman who serves on our board, who is the head of the incest treatment program in Lane County, has asked us to change the statistic on boys, because she believes that now it's fair to say that one out of six boys, instead of what we say there is one out of seven. She's not talked to us about new research on the other figures, But I will try to get something from them.
Great.
Sorry, I'm so vague.
I guess my bottom line question is, if I might, Mr. Chair, is that do you maintain that incest is occurring in anywhere from one-third to one-sixth of the families in the state? That's what your statistics
say. I think that when I talk about mothers, I think that possibly a third of the women in our society are mothers of molested children, and that's just going by the numbers of people that are probably mothers of girls, because those are the people who are telling. So, yeah, I think it's a very prevalent problem. It's not the neglectful, drug-addicted, awful people that you read about in the paper.
Absolutely not.
Ordinary people. We'll try to get
you
something better
than
that.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. All right, committee, here's the direction that we're going to go. I've asked counsel whether she would try and put together an amendment for us that goes in the direction that Representative Mannix suggested, that takes the approach from House Bill 2408 and broadens it so that we're not dependent on a law enforcement officer. I'm not going to try and steer the committee in that direction, only to tell you that we will come back and revisit both House Bill 2408 and House Bill 2410. Excuse me, sometime either Monday or Wednesday of next week. We will have that amendment plus any amendments that you propose or any of the amendments that any of the interested parties propose to bring in front of us at that point, and it will be my intention to work House Bill 2408 and or House Bill 2410 or some combination of both of them at that time. Okay. Can we be clear on that? All right. So we'll move out of public hearing on House Bill 2410. And we're going to briefly look at House Bill 2409 before we start working some of the other bills. We'll ask Mr. Welch to come up on House Bill 2409. We will then go to House Bill 2395 and ask Chris Gardner to come up and try and get House Bill 2395 into a workable form. All right, Mr. Welch, tell us, please, about House Bill 2409.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Welch with the Governor's Task Force on Sex Offenses Against Children. I'll keep this as brief as I can and yet be sensitive as I can to the importance of putting the bill in context. This issue is, I mentioned originally that there were three populations that we were concerned with this afternoon, and this is the third and the smallest. Specifically, this would be the group of young people who have been brought to the attention of the juvenile court as victims of abuse, who have been released to the custody of a non-abusing parent and are in the eyes of an investigator being subjected either subtly or patently to pressure to recant the allegation. Those who have been in the business for any period of time will tell you that the pressures on the child, you've just heard them from people who have been able to tell you about the family pressure and about the difficulty it is in disclosure. You might equally consider for a moment the devastating impact this has on a non-offending parent, not only from the standpoint of the fact that their child has been overreached in this particular way, but in effect that their own world has come to an abrupt end or certainly a change. The reactions to that by various parents, understandably, differ. Some people go through a very elaborate process of denial, either initially or sometimes gradually. And we have been aware in a number of cases of parents who finally convinced themselves the incident did not occur, or that if it did occur, it somehow was the victim's fault, and they go to work on an already traumatized victim to try to get them to reduce their story. We have district attorneys who have come to us, to the juvenile court, and asked for intervention in a case to remove a child from the custody of just such a person as I've identified. There are some judges who will write such an order. There are other judges who will not. There is no case law on the subject, and my own view is there's nothing within the juvenile code which addresses it, unless you are willing to take advantage of very subjective information or language. 419.476, which is the jurisdictional section of the juvenile code, in addition to the typical ones people think about as law violations and so on, have a couple of definitions which may address this but may not, depending on who the judge is. Specifically, 419.476(1)(c) says that a child is within the jurisdiction of the court whose behavior, condition, or circumstance are such as to endanger the welfare of the person or the welfare of others. But remember, this child's not in physical danger in my fact situation. It's an emotional war. So you might say, well, then how about subsection E, which is the garden variety dependency and neglect section? It says either the parents or any other person having custody of the person have abandoned, failed to provide with support for education, none of those, subjected the person to cruelty or depravity or to unexplained physical injury, or, and maybe this, failed to provide the person with the care, guidance, and protection necessary for the physical, mental, or emotional well-being of the person. One might argue that it's within the ambit of that language you would find my fact situation being addressed. I would submit to you that we shouldn't leave it to that wonder. You might say, does the criminal law provide for it under a material witness theory? It must not, or the DAs would not come to the juvenile court seeking this sort of relief. Therefore, what I ask you to do is accept the premise that this kind of child warrants interference in terms of interference with the parent-child relationship upon a showing to a judge that there's reasonable basis to believe that there's an effort being made for this child to recant. If that is the case, then I don't think it should be left to conjecture and to the language I've just talked about. And so what we have sought to do is not expand the jurisdiction of the court, but to expand the section of the law that speaks about what a judge may...
The task force, I think, in an effort to make them even more amenable to facilitating child victims in the courtroom. Is that accurate?
Thank you, counsel.
Also, just for the members' information, there was testimony last week regarding some U.S. Supreme Court decisions that could affect Oregon's law. They have been provided to you. There should be in your packet a copy of Idaho versus Wright and a copy of Maryland versus Craig. Interestingly enough, the Supreme Court in Idaho versus Wright came to a similar conclusion that the Oregon Supreme Court did in State versus Campbell, which was that hearsay evidence could not come in under the residual exception, which is what brought the hearsay exception bill to this legislative assembly last session. So in part, we're ahead of the Supreme Court. There are copies of the residual, which means that if there are other reasons why it ought to come in, it ought to come in.
Well, that's the old, it's hearsay, but it's great hearsay.
Yes, exactly. We should hear it. You know, we really shouldn't let it in, but it's good, so we're going to take it.
The Supreme Court has found against that?
No. No. Said that was inappropriate in this case.
Oh.
That's what it's really what they said. But that information has been provided to you, and I think that Mr. Gardner has some further suggestions in regards to 2395.
Mr. Gardner, welcome. Thank you for sticking around.
Thank you. I'm going to take a bit of advice from you, Chairman, that I heard you give in the back of the room, which was start at the beginning. And explain this, and I think then public advice in short sentences with small words. So I think the first thing that I'd like to address to the committee, and particularly because of a tone that I've picked up in some comments that I've heard, is just a very brief discussion of what we're talking about when we talk about child abuse and the consequences of it. I heard some skepticism as to a figure of one out of every three females is molested. There have been studies done that date back to 1944, studies done by Alfred Kinsey at Indiana University, who then published a really similar document on the issue of female sexuality. In the course of his studies in the late 1940s and 1950s, he determined that approximately 25% of the adult women he spoke to indicated they had been sexually abused as children. Those studies have been duplicated time and time again. Similar figures are found in every study. One very interesting study was conducted by the Los Angeles Times, and they did a nationwide survey. They confirmed the basic 1 in 4 figure for female victims and a figure somewhat lower than that for male victims. But they did a very interesting thing. This pollster, he wanted to find out from the respondents to the poll how many of them sexually abused children. Well, that creates a certain dilemma. You're sitting at home, you're a sexual abuser of children, your telephone rings, and an anonymous person asks you if you've ever sexually abused a child. So he, perceiving there'd be some dilemma in getting frank answers to that question, d- devised a double-blind system where the person was asked two questions, one of which is, do you ever sexually abuse children? Was then asked to flip a coin, one question being question heads and one question tails, and answer that question. Assuming then that it was a 50-50 split, the half the questionnaires had that non-offensive question, which I think was, do you rent or own your home, or do you rent a home, your home, or do you belong to a union, and the other questionnaires, and then they could determine and extrapolate anyway with some complex mathematical manipulation. They determined that one out of every 10 men interviewed admitted that they had sexually abused children, a rather sort of startling figure. One mathematical error I think you made is that molesters of children are responsible for more than one child. However, the child's only molested by one person, so it does not correlate that one in four women are molested, that one in four fathers are molesters, or one in eight if half of them are by the parent.
Well, Mr. Chair, but you know, the implication I'm trying to get to, however you take it out, that basically means there are 100,000 felons out in society.
That's exactly correct.
And I hate to tell you, but we're at maxed out already.
I understand that.
I'm dead serious. I mean, we're maxed out already. So, I mean, you sometimes wonder where the solution to this problem is. And when I look at those monstrous figures, 100,000 felons out there, you don't have to be hit with a baseball bat to know that you can't send 100,000 felons through the system. I mean, the solution has got to be found at a more basic level. I keep wondering, no one has ever given me an answer. You know, I just hate to get philosophical. I want to know why there are 100,000 abusers out there. And I mean, I'm serious.
Right.
I don't want any type of
right.
pablum about abuse leads to abuse. I want to know why there are 100,000 abusers out there. And I keep getting pablum, but that's...
Okay. This may well be, if you consider it pablum, then I'll consider it a whiplash, but let me go on just a moment.
Can I enter?
The workers' comp lawyer over here wants to point out
sure.
that it's not whiplash, it's a whip wound.
Oh, whip
there's
wound.
A difference.
I'm sorry.
Representative Mannix.
Either way, it'll hurt.
We can all debate the statistics,
right.
And I see a lot of articles that tell me that a lot of sex offenders also have hundreds of victims. So, no, I don't think one out of four parents or one out of eight parents are out there and that they're felons. But what I'm really interested in is I don't care how many are felons. I'm interested in dealing with the felony and the victim. And if we have victims out there, I'm interested in hearing what we can do to help us get the victims, help and protect them, and help us get after the perpetrators and either rehabilitate them or put them away. And, yeah, if we had to have 100,000 jail cells, I'll deal with that reality when I get there. We're not catching all of them. Could you please tell us on 2395 quickly where we should move with this?
Okay. If I may, if you don't object, I just would like to try and attempt to answer his question briefly. When we deal with child abuse as a criminal phenomena, unlike any other crime, the victim end of the equation is probably the most profound part of that equation. And the reason for that is very simple. In every category of dysfunctional adults, human beings who are abused as children are statistically overrepresented. Dr. Dorothy Antonow Lewis from NYU has done studies of death row inmates and finds that 95 to 100% of all death row inmates have significant histories of abuse or neglect. Studies of our prison populations show that 40 to 80% of our prison inmates have significant histories of abuse or neglect. Studies of our drug treatment centers, teen prostitutes, teen runaways, alcohol abuse treatment centers all show similar statistical realities. So there may be many paths to being a dysfunctional adult, but there's one four-lane highway, and that's the sexual, emotional, physical abuse, and neglect of children. And I would suggest that if we want to look at a solution to deal with the crime problem, just what you raise, it's intervening in these victims' lives and giving them the type of support that the abuse has robbed from them. And that's not the opportunity to learn math and Spanish and chemistry. It's the opportunity to learn trust and love and self-confidence, the very things when stripped away from a person that allow them to become our Charlie Mansons.
So,
Chairman, can I interject one thing? And what is the correlation between single-parent families there? You know what it is. It's just as high.
There's there may or may not be a problem with single-parent families.
Let's be very frank.
Okay. I would suggest to you that whatever the source of that family, if the child's being victimized directly, that there's very clear evidence that child has a less chance of succeeding, whether they're from a rich family or a poor family, a single-parent family, double-parent family, or a multiple-parent family.
Well, the correlation is it's single-parent family extremely high with all those other factors you've mentioned.
Right. It could be that many of those single-parent families are single-parent families because there has been abuse in the equation. Then the second thing that's come up here is this sense that we see in custody fights some explosion of false allegations. And I would suggest, and I can provide the documentation, but the American Council of, or the American Association of Family and Conciliation Courts with in association with the American Bar Association has done the most exhaustive survey to prove or disprove that fact, and they cannot prove it. And their findings are rather lengthy and published, and I can provide those to counsel for the committee for your review. So, and let me just suggest one other thing. The bottom line issue in dealing with child abuse is a resource issue. Almost everything you've heard here today tinkers with little things, but until we put resources into dealing with the problem, we may never be effective. But I came to address the children's hearsay statute, and I have some specific proposals as to ways to change it to make it more effective in giving the courts the ability to get before them the information they need to properly adjudicate these cases.
Okay, Mr. Gardner, I'm going to stop you and ask
yes.
you, is it true that the bill simply takes the basic concept that we did last session and extend it to the civil context
yes.
as well?
That is what the
okay.
bill as recommended does. And
okay.
the suggestions I have go well beyond that.
Okay.
I would first of all like to make this recommendation. This bill, if it applies to civil cases, will come into will come into the courtroom in approximately six situations: custody fights, civil damage litigation, tort litigation, termination of parental rights litigation, criminal litigation, juvenile dependency litigation, that is where the child is alleged to be a victim of a crime in need of services, and juvenile criminal litigation, where the sexual abuse perpetrator is a juvenile themselves. Now, when we look and analyze those six situations, what we find is that four of them are focused on the perpetrator and have sanctions for the perpetrator. Civil damages, money sanctions against the perpetrator, termination of parental rights, the most probably serious sanctions against perpetrators, second only maybe to criminal prosecution, which have penal sanctions, and juvenile criminal prosecution. Two of those have as their ultimate goal determining what is in the best interest of the child. That's a custody proceeding and a juvenile dependency case. And I would suggest that they fall into then two categories for purposes of the analysis that I would like to propose here. The first recommendation I would make is, I think you can find it on line two of page three. The last word in that sentence is a statement. It says, a statement made by a child victim who's under 10 years of age, which statement describes an act of sexual conduct performed with or on the child by another. I would recommend that the word describes be changed to the word concerns. I have been in courtrooms where a mother was testifying as to statements from her child and said, I asked the child what she was wearing in the motel room where she was sexually abused. And my daughter told me, objection, Your Honor, that doesn't describe the act of sexual conduct. Certainly setting the scene for the act concerns that act and should be admissible in order to bring to bear to the trier of fact a complete explanation of what the child has said. That's probably the surest way we can determine, and frankly, it's frequently the only evidence we have to determine, is the child telling the truth, is there credibility or not to this statement. So I would suggest changing the word describes to concerns. My second recommendation, in the situation where a child is unavailable as a witness and is under 10 years of age, is to change the language found I believe it's line 10, to change the language now, which reads, of the defendant's participation in the conduct, to, and the complete sentence would be, however, when the child is unavailable as a witness, the statement may be admitted in evidence only if there is corroborative evidence of the act of sexual conduct and of, and I would change it to, the defendant's opportunity to participate in the conduct. Now, there's a specific reason that I make that recommendation, because if you look down at the bottom of page 3, there's a list of factors that the court may consider in determining whether there's sufficient indicia of reliability for these statements to be admitted. The last factor there, M, is whether extrinsic evidence exists to show the accused opportunity to commit the act which the child statement refers. The case, the Idaho case, the case of Idaho versus Wright, the U.S. Supreme Court held that it is unconstitutional to consider facts extrinsic to the statement itself in order to determine its reliability. Therefore, factor M is no longer available as set forth in this statute per Idaho versus Wright. So what I would suggest is that we pull factor M out and write it into the statute as sufficient evidence to corroborate the defendant's participation in the act. To be very blunt, that's the only evidence we generally have as to the defendant's participation in the act, and that is to corroborate his opportunity to commit the act. We occasionally get cases with videotapes of the act. We occasionally get something like a DNA match, and that's very rare. It's never been used in a child abuse case in this state now. If we've got a videotape, we don't need this statute. So those are the two recommendations in that context. Now, at this point, I'd just like to take a second, particularly for the non-lawyers on the committee, to talk just a little bit about hearsay. The rule against hearsay says that you can't bring into court a statement offered for the truth of the matter asserted by an out-of-court asserter unless they're present in the courtroom. So what we don't want to have happen is somebody coming into court and saying, well, Joe told me that Bill said that they ran the red light, right? You got to get Bill in there to say whether or not he ran the red light. Over the course of the history of our jurisprudence, there have been denominated, I've once heard the figure of over 200 exceptions to the hearsay rule. Now, those exceptions, and let me give you an example of a couple of them. One of those would be a dying declaration. The purpose of that is, and the reason, the justification for it, is we assume that a person on their deathbed doesn't want to go to their maker with a lie on their lips. So if they say it and then they die, we admit it as hearsay. An excited utterance, where a person under the influence of an exciting event blurts out some statement. It comes in. Why? We don't assume that a person in an exciting circumstance would have time to make up a lie. Therefore, it has indicia of reliability or trustworthiness. The final one that's relevant here would be a statement to a doctor for purposes of medical treatment. We would assume that a person with a broken arm wouldn't go to the doctor and complain of back pain, would in fact be honest with the doctor about their sensations and what they're feeling in order to get. So we admit those statements without the asserter, the out-of-court asserter, being present. Now,
let me just stop you and ask you, where were you when I was in law school? You just made it awfully, awfully easy, and I could have used you during my first year of law school. Go ahead.
You write to this barber first.
Thank you. That was a very flattering thing to say.
The only good one you get today.
And now I've completely lost my point, so I probably wasn't there because I couldn't handle students' questions.
230 kinds of hearsay, and those are some examples.
You're going through some of the exceptions and the reasons.
Okay. Now, what we do when we allow hearsay into a courtroom is we say that because of this inherent circumstance, we trust that statement to come in. But if it comes into a criminal trial, the case Mapp versus Ohio, is it Mapp or no, it isn't. Not Mapp versus Ohio. Something versus Ohio, counsel probably knows. Regardless, I think it's Ohio versus Roberts. What they said was is that we now have the interplay between a defendant's right to confront witnesses against them, and aren't we violating that when we allow in a hearsay statement? And the U.S. Supreme Court concluded, no, we're not. But the Confrontation Clause provides the defendant with certain additional protections not normally provided for in the hearsay exception. Those protections are, number one, to use hearsay in a criminal case, the state must prove that their witness is unavailable. That is, that they tried to find that out-of-court asserter. In the case of the dying declaration, that'd probably be fairly simple. In other examples, it's not so easy. The state needs to prove that they're unavailable. And the second one was that it needs to fall within a traditional hearsay exception, number one, or two, you need to establish independently by evidence factors leading to trustworthiness of the statement, which was just the intent of this statute. Okay? Now, what do we give up when we let in hearsay? We give up the ability to test the statement by cross-examining the witness. Now, I'm glad there are a lot of lawyers here, because frankly, that's one of the least frequent effective ways to get a witness to break down and show that they're lying. How many of you as lawyers have had a witness break down on the stand during your cross-examination and say, oh, it's the Perry Mason syndrome. As a matter of fact, in voir dire, I always warn juries that it's not like Perry Mason. Neither Della Street will walk into the back of the courtroom, nor will I break down any defendant.
Although, Mr. Gardner, just listening to your accent, I have to wonder if you haven't practiced with Ben Matlock a little bit. You wear a white suit in Atlanta from time to time?
No, I wear a light blue suit in Bend, however. Now, when we give that up, are we giving up the only way we can attack those statements? And let me suggest we're not. For instance, with a dying declaration, we could put on extrinsic evidence from a third party that the person who made the declaration was an atheist and therefore had no motive not to lie on their deathbed. Or that the statement they'd made the day before was, if it's the last thing I do with my dying breath, I'll get even with Joe. So there are ways to attack hearsay statements that are not involved in the ability to cross-examine that witness. Now, let me get on to setting that stage, the other recommendations I would make. I would recommend redrafting the statute to allow the out-of-court statements concerning the sexual abuse of a child of any age without any showing whatsoever if they're available to testify and available for cross-examination. Some jurisdictions, Indiana, for instance, defines an out-of-court statement by an available witness who testifies as not hearsay, period. The reason I would recommend that is that in the typical child sexual abuse case, the most compelling evidence available is the history of how the child revealed their abuse, and it is frequently the only evidence available. Now, it may be the child revealed the abuse by laughing and joking with their friends the first occasion. That might lead you to conclude the child's not credible. It may be it was a tearful revelation after going through a good touch, bad touch program to their teacher. That may lead you to conclude the child's statements are credible. But regardless, if the child's available as a witness, is available to be cross-examined about the out-of-court statements, there's no confrontation clause problem, there's no hearsay problem, that evidence should simply be allowed into a court for the trier of fact to listen and give whatever weight they conclude. Secondly, I would strongly suggest that we define in the statute a lower standard of admissibility for the use of these hearsay statements in juvenile court dependency cases than we have for admissibility in criminal cases. I am sensitive to the fact, and even as a district attorney, I'm sensitive to the fact that we do not want to convict innocent people. In fact, we're prepared to err on the side of the guilty when applying criminal sanctions. In other words, we're prepared to let some guilty people go free in order to protect rights for all of us. However, in a juvenile dependency case, there is only one ultimate issue. What is in the best interest of this child? I would suggest, and I've had personal experience recently with this situation, what's happening is that the courts are defining indicia of reliability by going to the constitutional definition provided in Idaho versus Wright, which is it sufficiently trustworthy that the utility of cross-examination would be marginal? That's a fairly high standard to meet. And in addition, then, the courts require that we put forward corroborating evidence of the act of sexual conduct and of the defendant's participation in it, which I've already suggested should be changed to opportunity. Now, think about it. In a typical child sex abuse case, what evidence are we going to have to corroborate the act? If we got the videotape, we don't need the statute. So what typically do we have? We may, in approximately a quarter of all cases, maybe less, have some physical evidence, i.e., the hymenal ring of the female victim may have a notch in it. Can a doctor testify there's only one way that notch could have gotten there and it was sex abuse? No. No doctor worth their salt will testify to that. We may have the child behaviorally acting out, locking doors around themselves, getting into regressive behavior, beginning to bedwet, having night terrors, going back to baby talk and thumb sucking at a developmentally inappropriate age. Is that evidence the child suffered trauma? Yes. Is it exclusively evidence that the child was sex abused? No. So we have a real limited capacity to do that, to provide that corroborating evidence. I don't complain of that standard in a criminal case. A human being's liberty interests are at stake. We don't want to put innocent people in prison. But in a juvenile dependency case, is it appropriate to force the state to meet that burden before those out-of-court statements can come into evidence? I'm going to put this in hypothetical terms, but it's based on facts. A child makes 27 complaints alleging that her father sexually abused her. She's 4 years old. One of those complaints, and I don't do this to offend, but I think it's important that you realize sort of what we're talking about when we get these statements. The child is being interviewed with two anatomically correct dolls. She's 4 years old. She is asked to undress the dolls, which are identified as her and her father. She is asked, and when she's asked to undress the dolls, she's told, let's pretend like we're going to bathe the dolls. She's asked if her father ever touches her. And the child says yes. It's okay for fathers to touch daughters. And she asks how the father touches you. And the child takes the male doll's hand and puts it between the female doll's legs. It's even all right for fathers to bathe their children between their legs. Fairly ambiguous evidence. She is asked if she ever touches the father. And she says yes. And she's asked, what happens when you touch the father? And she reaches down and takes the male doll's penis, which is hanging between its legs, and lifts it up to the position of an erection and demonstrates masturbation. She's asked if she's ever seen it at any other time. And the child says yes. And she's asked, what did it look like then? And she puts it back between the doll's legs. Gee, that's a pretty startling event. What I'm suggesting is, in that case, this hypothetical, the judge ruled that these 27 statements did not have sufficient indicia of reliability, primarily because there were expert witnesses who testified that the child could be suffering from parental alienation syndrome and other factors that may or may not have some merit. There were a major battle of the experts in this case. Did not have sufficient indicia of reliability, i.e. it was not so trustworthy that we could conclude that cross-examination would be of marginal utility, and that there was not sufficient corroborative evidence. And it didn't come into the criminal trial. I do not complain of that ruling. Hypothetically, the case is represented to the same judge with the same facts in a juvenile petition, and the judge rules that I'm going to apply exactly the same standard I applied in the criminal case, and this evidence doesn't come in. Now, we have a very different situation when we're talking about a juvenile proceeding. In a criminal case, for the non-lawyers, once again, and I hope this is illuminating to you, Chairman, but in the criminal case,
don't
we begin with the scales of justice entirely tipped to the defendant. That's called the presumption of innocence. And the state has the burden of putting on evidence until the position of the scales are basically reversed. And that's called beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil case, the standard is preponderance of the evidence, which is also the standard in the juvenile dependency case. That is to say, the scales begin evenly balanced. The issue is, what's the more likely than not explanation in this hypothetical for this child making these statements? Is it that she was abused? Well, she recanted once. Well, that may tip it back. We've got to explain the recantation. Is it that she was coached? Gee, it's pretty hard to explain how a 4-year-old could be coached to answer questions like the situation I described. Once again, we test the different facts. And yet, in this hypothetical, which did occur, we couldn't even get to the question because the evidence wasn't admissible. What I'm suggesting to you is if we have the same standard for admissibility in juvenile dependency cases that we have in criminal cases, we may set a standard for admissibility of the evidence that is here when the burden of proof is here. We may keep evidence out that would be sufficient to prove it's more likely than not the child was sexually abused because we have too high a standard to get it into the courtroom before the trier of fact.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Baumann,